Hello.
Hello. Ooh, you're a little Skypey there.
Oh. Am I?
Quite. I turned on the thing while you're Skyping.
Oh, good. I just paused Dropbox. It wasn't doing anything, but you never know. Might as well just be superstitious.
Damn Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
I still got a Keyboard Maestro macro that shuts off a bunch of stuff and opens all my associated apps and what have you.
Yeah, I want to... There's the... What is it? Trip something that a lot of podcasters use. Jason Snell found that it was a good thing because it basically like limits which programs can connect over... get network access. So if you're traveling, you don't have to worry about like accidentally using up a data plan or something. But you can just as easily configure it so that you have a podcast preset you use at home, and it turns off all of the network access for all the programs you don't want.
I am unfamiliar with that tool.
Yeah. As I said the name, which was the thing that I don't remember, I highly recommend it because I've never used it.
You said trip something.
Yes. I'll look it up later. So Dan, how are you on the eve of the twilight of
the twilight of the winter of our discontent?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was warm today. It's pretty nice. It was like mid-80s still.
It was warm here too. It was in the upper 80s.
Mm-hmm. I had some difficulty getting out of bed, which is okay because I'm unemployed, so that's fine.
Oh, was it difficulty due to your election night festivities? Or
no, just my will to live kind of withered.
Yeah. That was one of the things I was really excited about. 6:30 in the morning when my alarm went off, I was just like, oh, right. Gotta get going.
I have been mostly unable to shake the feeling for the whole day. I think there was maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes or so where I had to do a little bit of work. They kind of distracted me a little bit. But, you know, I tried listening to some podcasts, tried listening to some music, and I just had to, like, I had to pause and, like, rewind every podcast I tried to listen to because I just wasn't listening to it. So it was... We shouldn't go too deep down this because this is not a
it's not a happy fun place.
No, it's not a happy fun place. I am quite upset.
Yeah.
About the things, I put a curse word on Facebook and then I deleted Facebook off my phone because I can't even bear any of it. It's not even a place I can go right now. I've heard some secondhand, thirdhand stories from other people on Facebook, but. I can't deal with any of that right now.
I don't use it, as I've mentioned to you before, but I have the account still. So I'm considering just completely deleting it entirely, just so it never comes into contact with my being again. But maybe that's a little extreme or not. But I am repelled. It's great. Things are great in America right now because it's been made that way by horrible things that have occurred. So rather than perpetually dwell on this for hopefully only 4 years, let's try to look on the bright side of stuff. We had talked previously, we had planned this far in advance that I would watch The Nice Guys because I had rented it because it was on sale for 99 cents on Amazon Video. I finally got around to doing that. And so that was our plan. So there's not any direct connection to any recent events for why this was selected. It was the magic calendar.
Oh, did you find parallels to modern events?
Oh, well, just people in the Rust Belt messing stuff up, and they mentioned Hitler a couple times, but what else could it possibly be?
the hopelessness of protesting against the government. Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
That's an undertone. That luckily, there's enough content in this movie that you can avoid all of that stuff and still have a good time.
Yes,
but yeah, this is a movie that I was looking forward to since I saw the trailer. Whenever this movie came out, I should probably look on the IMDb page. I don't even really know where it is. But
May 15th.
I enjoyed the trailer. Yep, I enjoyed the trailer earlier this year. I saw it in the theaters. I enjoyed it when I saw it in the theaters. I pre-ordered it as soon as I got out of the theater. Well, like a week later. Watched it. I think I've seen it two or three times now. At home on iTunes, and I enjoy this movie. It's you know, it's like a goofy 70s era cop sort of. I don't even know if you want to call it a cop procedural, but a little bit. And it's Shane Black writing, directing, and it's funny. And there's actually a story to it. It's a weird story, but it's a story.
Yeah, it's more of a detective movie than a traditional. Procedural, like these are down
the
and
private
out.
Eyes.
Private eyes. Well, one of them isn't even a private eye. He just beats people up for money.
Yeah, he punches people in the face for money. It's, you know, it's good gig if you can get it. I mean, you got to live above a bar in a tiny apartment
and hold on to a bag that has a blue dye pack in it. But for reasons that are never fully explained. But it's really. Quite entertaining, I agree with you. There are some peculiar, weird flaws, perhaps, in certain constructions of this, but nothing too terrible. And I would heartily endorse this as something that people should watch. So if you are,
exact opposite of last week.
Yeah. Well, God. And what's weird is. Dazed and Confused last week, which I did not enjoy, that is also sort of the same era, which is why we picked that, and it was supposed to be very, well, it is critically acclaimed, and I'm the only person on the planet Earth who doesn't like the movie, but...
Well, you haven't finished it yet. I'm sure you'll love it once you finish it.
Yeah, I'm sure there are probably more people who like Dazed and Confused who don't like Nice Guys than the reverse, but I quite
well.
Enjoy
we don't have
nice
to be
guys.
Friends with those people because they're stupid.
No, right? We just clearly only focus on our votes and we'll be fine. So the pain.
Draw a line in the 1970s era sand.
Oh man, and some of those peculiarities about how this movie was made. It is. Right there from the get-go when you get the Warner Brothers logo, and it's the old Saul Bass Warner Brothers logo, and then it flips to new animated logos, and then it goes back to the 70s for the title. And I was just kind of like, guys, come on. Like, get rid of the new stuff. Just either make it look fake old or just put it on text on a card. Like, it doesn't need the animated... CG logo. It's totally it ruins the flow of it for the 70s, but whatever production company that was that I've already forgotten. Oh, Waypoint Entertainment. They shouldn't have done that, and I hope they regret it every day of their lives, because this was a rare opportunity for them to not shine. Literally not shine.
I think we're intermixing our commentary again, but yes, I have no idea what you're talking about, because I totally didn't pay attention to the credits this time.
You see, if I'm watching a period piece, I get very drawn to the parts of it that feel of the time period. I know that not everything is going to be literally of that time period, because the manufacturing and archivalness and the quality of things that are there for nostalgia more than how it would have actually been constructed if it was actually in the time period. You know, all that stuff kind of flows and fluctuates depending on which movie you're watching. And one of the things about this also was the music. And while last week I had complained there was a lot of 70s music that was inserted into that 1993 movie at a breakneck clip, where we were just basically going from one 1970s hit to the next. This one used it sparingly, but it supplemented all of that with scoring from John Ottman and David Buckley, and they scored it as if it was a contemporary action piece, and I did not agree with that decision at all. It felt really weird, and it took me out. Like when they're all like punching and fighting and stuff, it didn't feel like it was that time period. You know, you listen to even the ridiculous scoring of Austin Powers, and it fits the era they're trying to evoke, that sort of 60s spy stuff. And in this, it's just, you know, rather than evoking the 70s, it's just like, yeah, it's just like actiony punchy stuff, and it's just like, okay, great, thanks for having two composers on this. Blah.
Well, I didn't notice or mind any of that, because I, you know, it's background, I didn't really care that much. But does that mean you wish they would have used optical compositing for all the visual effects?
No. I thought the opening shot was a little weird. There are a few of these aerial look at the flat city lights of Los Angeles shots in this film. And that's because a lot of it was shot in Georgia. And
it's very stylized too. They were going for more a stylized thing in addition to just sort of the nighttime, because they're trying to create this like dirty, smoggy version of LA that I'm not entirely sure how accurate it is. I'm sure Los Angeles was disgusting, but I don't know if it was this specifically then, and it's probably not now. So, you know, they had to dial it up for the story aspect of it. But did you like?
That seemed to fit with the photos I've seen of 1970s Los Angeles. Like, I was obviously not here nor alive, but like photographically speaking, it was just like, okay, fine, that's consistent enough.
Was it the move in particular that bothered you? Because it is a weird sort of helicoptery zoom move.
Yeah, because it kind of flies over the back of the Hollywood sign stuff and things, and then there's some other one where it goes over the house and then up past it after he goes in to look at the city again, and it's just like, that's not really the point of that shot, so I don't know why we ended on it. And then when they go to Sid's party, there's also another big old aerial thing, and it's just like, guys, I know we haven't left Los Angeles, you just keep showing us a big grid of city lights.
Well, they're going into the fancy Hollywood Hills.
Yes. I thought it was Bel Air.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, anyway.
Who's on a hill?
Doesn't matter. But I, you know, having said those criticisms about the construction of that, I still really enjoyed setting it in the 1970s, and also the costume work and makeup work and, you know, all that went into it was great, except for Kim Basinger. I don't know what was happening with her hair. That was weird. But everything else was pretty enjoyable.
You appreciate Ryan Gosling's various suits and later how they were custom sort of split to fit his cast.
Yes. Yes. I don't know. They were great. And I feel like they were appropriately attired. Like Russell Crowe definitely looked like a washed up, down on his luck guy who's not doing too well. And, you know, they dressed him like that too. He wasn't just like that on set. And so it worked great.
Mm-hmm.
And I like Holly. I found her to be precocious. I don't typically enjoy child actors most of the time. I find them to be grating.
Children in general.
Yeah, or children in general. That's very true. But she was perfectly good in the role that she had. She sparred adequately with Ryan Gosling. She was a little too goody-two-shoes in a couple scenes where I didn't quite believe her precociousness. But,
are you talking about the be nice and don't kill people stuff?
Yeah, and like, oh no, you can't kill him or I'll never talk to you again. And it's just like he was literally threatening your life. Cool it. He was trying to shoot you dead. But yeah,
take the high road.
Yeah, the road less traveled by,
especially in Los Angeles,
by 276 something. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the important thing is that we get also the elements of this mystery that sort of unfold throughout the course of the beginning of this movie, and they sort of don't come together until much later. Now, some of the things are a little more successful than others, where you can kind of predict where things will wind up, rather than being like totally shocked. But that's all right. It wasn't so lamentably bad that I was just like, you idiots.
I think the first time I thought I saw this movie, I think I made it like 3/4 of the way through the movie before I realized, like, oh, there's a plot here too. I thought it was going to be all sort of like Lebowski kind of nonsense where they're just going places and doing things and antics ensue. But like, oh, there's actually like a relatively complex story behind what's actually happening here. And the second time I watched it, I'm like, okay, I think I get it now. It's a weird plot, and I don't know how much of it is purported to be true, but
I believe zero things.
You believe zero things? I don't know. I wasn't alive back then, and I haven't done much research into the auto industry from the 70s.
Yeah, it's fine. But
I believe that they were colluding to make catalytic converters that didn't do stuff.
Yeah, but
I believe that would be true.
Yeah, but it's sort of like Roger Rabbit, where it's just like, yes. It's exactly like that. That's what happened to the streetcars. But so the thing here, though, is that we get a very strange opening where there's that shot over the Hollywood Hills and the sign, and then down to the house, and the kid goes inside, and he
it's
goes
the kid from Iron Man.
He goes underneath the parents' bed and grabs a magazine, takes it into the hallway, and immediately starts looking at the dirty magazine, which is very weird. And it is a dirty, dirty magazine because there is a lady who is posed with her chest area exposed. And I have to say, this is one of those things that just makes me roll my eyes about that. It's like, we didn't technically need to see like the detail of it, but more to the point, when the car goes flying through the house, which we get that nice shot of it going over the cliffs in the background before it actually drives through. Once you find her in the wreckage, she's posed exactly the same as she is in the spread, and it's supposed to be one of those sort of surreal moments of how could that possibly have happened. But instead, I'm just like, why is this the first shot in your movie? Like,
what is a peculiar scene.
Yeah, like, what are you as the director trying to tell me about the film that I'm going to be watching? And I don't find that to be representative of the rest of the film.
No, not at all.
It just seems very strange. So if you're turned off by that first scene and you're just like, oh no, I can't watch this. This is horrible. What is it going to be? Just like this for the rest of the time? It's not. But that does raise the question of why.
We don't see that set or those characters ever again. We talk about them a lot. But yeah, I mean, what do we get from that opening scene aside from like a surprise and like an entrance into introducing the 70s era stuff? We get the actress with her license, her name on the license plate, and the name of the movie. And you're like, wow, that was a weird thing she said before dying. I wonder if I'll figure out what that meant later.
Yeah. And we don't come back to anything related to that for quite some time. And it goes to the whole thing with Russell Crowe and beating people up, and his voiceover where he talks about, you know, I don't know, what was it, Irish and being from the Bronx and blah 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 blah, and punches people.
Yeah, I mean, there's another sort of unusually drawn out intro where we see the kids in school watching that very odd movie, and then girl runs off to go get high with the guy.
Yeah, I didn't like that movie.
No,
that was
the kids laughing, and you know he's, you know, it's meant to be, you know, saying the kids are all screwy these days. His 14-year-old girl is off a rocker and doing bad things with older men. What's it come to? And I'm just a simple straight shooter here from wherever in
the Bronx,
just trying to make a buck or whatever. And I like that when we see him, he's outside the guy's house eating peanuts and throwing the shells into the open window of his car. But before that, you know, the you know, in addition to the car driving to the house part, like the whole school thing there was quite odd and probably unnecessary.
Yeah. Also, he had a line where he said she's 13 years old and he's three times her age, and so I was just like, oh my god. He's 39 years old? What is happening? Because he also doesn't actually appear that, but whatever, he gets beat up. We never see him again. And
I like the swiftness with which he is punched in the face with brass knuckles. And, you know, there's some nice choreography to, like, how you see him put the brass knuckles on, and he walks up there, and are you the man? What? And then just socks him right in the face.
Yeah, and it's obvious from what he says to the guy that he was hired by the girl's dad to beat the guy up. And that he does this for money. This isn't just purely out of some sort of vigilante sense of justice where he pursues people from schools. But there, we also get to Ryan Gosling, who wakes up in his bathtub, and he's in a suit in a tub of water.
A very strange introduction to him, but you pretty quickly get the idea that he is a messed up drunk in a very weird place in his life.
Yeah, he is a raging alcoholic, which is an important theme because of the third act. But the thing here is that we can't quite piece together what has happened to cause this to occur, or if he does this every night or whatever. But there's the message from his daughter. It's not clear where she lives or anything, but we get that in a. Shortly in the following scene. And there's the whole thing about Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling's paths crossing because Amelia hires Russell Crowe to go after the guy who's after her, and she found the information about him. So he goes and he beats up Ryan Gosling. And it's actually kind of funny because he forgot his brass knuckles and he's all disappointed about it, and he's got to go do it the old-fashioned way, and he talks about how he's gonna break his arm and stuff, and there's all this fighting in which it becomes very clear that Ryan Gosling, while he might be a private detective and have a license to carry a firearm, he is really bad at what he does, and he also is kind of cowardly and a wimp. And so it's pretty funny. There are a few times where he like when he finally gets throttled to the ground by Russell Crowe, and the arm behind the back, and, you know, oh, tell them when you go to the hospital that you have a fracture of your, what was it, radial something something. And there's this snapping noise with the most amazing little high-pitched squeal from Ryan Gosling. And so I love the care that went into putting together exactly how his character behaves, because he's sort of a flailing, almost Sam Rockwell mess
of a character. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah,
and it's perfect for Gosling too, because he's very well able to tap into that sort of deadpan humor at times, and sort of over the top slapstick. Like, there's a point in there where he's basically doing Abbott and Costello when he rolls down the hill, mm-hmm. and he can't talk, and it's equally as hilarious as it was back then. But it's he does it all so well that I'm so glad he's in this.
Oh, well, that's when he finds the dead body, and he's got the light, and he goes over and he goes
stammering and slapping and pointing and wheezing. It's all very good.
He just needed to shout up, "Hey, Abbott!" But
instead of Healy. Yeah, I mean, the thing I like about this too is that, like, the humor, it's dense with humor, and a lot of it is just sort of, it's not like pause for laugh track kind of humor. It's just breeze past. It's like, it's almost dense in like a Sorkin esque kind of way, where there's a lot of little bits and pieces here and there that are either references to other things or just flat out funny in and of themselves, but they just, you know, they're a backdrop to this overall story, and the characters and the humor between them just really makes the ride very fun.
Yeah, if this was a straight action movie, it would not be worth watching, especially as you had mentioned earlier, the plot is bonkers. But it works
it's
better.
Cobra.
Yeah, it works better for a comedy, and it really comes down to the banter and the physical comedy of some of these fight scenes, because they are really inept in ways that you kind of always would think would happen inside of action movies, but you never see happen, and then you finally see it here, and you're like, oh my god, that's so perfect. Like when Russell Crowe wants Ryan Gosling to throw him the gun. In a normal action movie, Ryan Gosling would throw the gun, and Russell Crowe would catch it, and that would just happen, and that would be exactly the way things would go. Because there's no reality to intercede there. It would be bad if that were to not actually occur. And so what actually happens in this film is that Ryan Gosling throws the gun out the window, and they look at each other like, "Are you serious?" And that's one of those moments where it's funny because it wasn't supposed to be a problem, and then it becomes a new problem because they're so bad at what they're doing.
But don't worry, he has a second gun in the cookie jar that he brings over.
It just really makes these scenes all the more interesting. Because, like I said, if they were straight action scenes and he threw him the gun and he had it and he shot the other guy, they'd be too competent, and then this wouldn't be entertaining at all. And it is actually through their sort of bumbling foolishness that we have the entertainment that we get out of this.
Yeah, it's almost the exact opposite of the folks from Lethal Weapon, also a Shane Black script, but it's these people are more fun to be around, I think.
Yeah, and we also get introduced to some interesting side characters through the course of the film. First with Bo Knapp and Keith David, who are playing some interesting
roles. Blueface and the older guy?
Yeah. They couldn't even give Keith David a named part. He's just the older guy. Come on. He's Keith David. But, you know,
they could have called him Red Suit Guy, because he's got that sweet red suit at the party.
Oh, that is an amazing red suit. He for some reason, he's wearing it at the car show later, too. Maybe he just has lots of red suits. It's an interesting look, but
it's a good look. Yeah, so I mean, you know, red looks good on him. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you have a couple red suits laying around?
Yeah, and so when we had talked about The Thing and you had talked about Keith David and he looks so much younger now, and I'm like, I don't think I've seen him recently, and then I watched this movie and I was just like, oh, that's what Dan meant.
He's perfected his Keith David face in this movie, that's for sure.
Yeah, he was very fun though.
I even love like when Blueface is going off on Russell Crowe in his apartment there and throwing the fish at him, and he's like, can you get this guy to behave like a professional? And he just kind of like shrugs like, I don't know, man, I just work with this guy, he's crazy, what do you want to do?
Yeah, like you get the sense that these are also bumbling henchmen. They're not as professional as perhaps some of the other people. And I like the fish scene. It's an obviously fake fish, of course, that he wiggles and throws, but it just it's wacky, and Bo Knapp is a little over the top, and there's the whole thing where they get out of that situation and somebody across the apartment building next door gets shot, and then they all run out of there as he shoots after them, and they'll cross paths once more. And because of this incident and realizing that it was connected to Amelia, he goes back to the guy who was following Amelia, the private detective, and they work out a deal where he's going to hire him. They come to an agreement where he'll pay for, 2 days? And that will be the extent to which that he'll help him find Amelia, because she might be in trouble from these guys. And that's all he's willing to do. And they start off by going to the protest group, which is in front of the LA City Hall, and they're all protesting by pretending to be dead with gas masks on because they've been killed.
The smog, yeah. The birds can't breathe. The smog killed them. Gas mask didn't help?
Yeah. Oh, dear. And so,
by the way, saddest part of the movie is probably when they hit Russell Crowe over the head and he drops his two cases of Yoo-Hoo all over the floor.
Oh, so much Yoo-Hoo. No use crying over spilled not milk, but
it's a chocolate mess all over the floor.
Yeah. And the only reason he bought those is because he got one from Holly, who courteously offered him one once before she realized that he beat up her dad. And
she didn't even care. Like when she saw him later, she's like, hey, you're the guy that beat up my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Sucker punched.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Oh, so good. And so they make this agreement that he'll do it at the bowling alley. And that's where we first get introduced to Janet, who becomes a running bit, which I quite adored because there's no real reason for it. Janet doesn't play into the film in any particular way other than no one likes Janet. So she just becomes the butt of the joke.
She's very annoying about his language. Yeah. Isn't she the one who throws the bowling ball backwards and almost hits everybody?
Yeah, she's. You took the Lord's name in vain. No, I didn't. Janet.
Found it to be very useful.
Yeah, and then when even Holly doesn't like Janet, when she comes over to the table, she tries to get Russell Crowe, she tries to pay Russell Crowe to go beat up Janet because she doesn't like her. So
$30. She's really annoying.
Yeah, and
tall.
On top of that, Ryan Gosling keeps getting her friend Jessica and Janet confused for the rest of the film. And she keeps it rings true because there are so many occasions where parents don't remember or can tell apart the different people in their child's lives, perhaps, because it's the one with a brunette. It's just like they're both brunettes. But they, it's the one.
Yeah,
I
don't even know my kids' friends' names.
Yeah, well, you don't have them.
I didn't. Yeah, that's why. But I still don't know their names.
Okay, so. Pulling us back from that time travel ledge, since this is
they're teaming up to go find Amelia, and he gets to keep his $400, even if they find her ahead of time. But they find the protest group. She's not there. He steps on a dead person's hand.
Yeah, but
they're not dead.
They find Chet, the projectionist,
projectionalist,
and he takes them to Dean. What's his face? Dean. I'm going to call him Dean. And so they go to his burned
well,
down.
That's his name, so good.
Yeah, his burned down house, and he's like, "Oh, there's a lot more space now."
And it's very open concept once you burn the building down.
They talk about all the film. It just burned up, and unfortunately, he died in the fire, and it was 3 days ago, and she's been so sad about it since then. It's just like,
yeah, he lost his life and his life's work. Really makes you think. No, it doesn't.
And then there's the kid who's riding by, and Ryan Gosling stops him, and he's just like, "Hey, about the guy who lived here?" And he's just like, "What's it to you?" And then Chet volunteers, "They'll pay you $20 because Chet had been paid $20. And so the kid wants $20 now. And Ryan Gosling's so pissed. I love it. And he unfortunately gives the kid money, and the kid keeps rambling on about it and like, "Oh, it's a porn film, and it's the Sid guy, and I talked to them, the producer guy, about how they were going to make it, and that's how I know it's going to happen, blah, 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 blah." And he's just like, "Oh, geez. Is there any useful information you can give us other than Sid Hatrack, which is not a real name?" And the kid's like, "No, I tried to..."
Nobody's named Sid Hatrack.
I tried to get a job. I was going to... was it? He just like kept talking about how he was gonna basically like flash for them, and they're just like, "No, nobody wants to see that. No one wants to see it.
$20 for to see it." It's like, nobody wants. It's like, why am I even? We already gave you 20. What am I talking about? Get out of here, kid.
Yeah, and they start driving around on Sunset, which is made to look like old timey Sunset, mostly by cropping in very tightly on buildings that would have been there, and not revealing the other ones that wouldn't have been, and. They drive past a billboard where he pulls over to the side, and there's a rather grotesque version of Pinocchio, which appears to be Sid with his big, long, curved nose and several naked ladies who are mounted on top of it, which is, God, I don't know how they could get away with that in the 70s, if that is based on any kind of real advertisement. I would assume it is not, but I'm just hoping that it isn't, because that's just revolting.
There's probably a part of Los Angeles where a billboard like that would be acceptable back then.
Yeah. Oh, Sunset.
Back before they came in and built all of the themed casinos and turned it into a family place.
Yeah. So they decide to call him up. They get invited to his party, and they're going to go there, and Holly should go with her friend, Janet. And she's like, "No, Jessica."
Jessica.
Yeah, and he's like, "Yeah, Janet, Jessica, whatever." just get out of here. And she reluctantly agrees. They go out to his car. They drive over there. And then once they get to the valet for the party, there's a noise in the trunk as if it was the little chimpanzee from Speed Racer. And inside is Holly, and she wants to go to the party. And he closes the trunk and tries to give the keys to the valet. And the valet's like, I'm not going to take the car because you have a kid in the trunk of your car. And he reluctantly lets Holly out and sends her home in a cab. They go inside the party. Everything is bonkers in there. They decide to split up, and it is very 70s party, is all I can say.
It's a Hollywood sex party full of painted naked women and mermaids and art statue women peoples, and then Earth, Wind, and Fire is there.
And
not the actual Earth, Wind, and Fire.
just the elements.
That's the name of the cover band that was doing the song, The Elements.
Oh, God.
It's the name of the apartments I lived in San Jose.
The Elements?
I think it was just Elements, but yeah.
Elements, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So not The Elements.
No.
Could have been any Elements.
I mean, sure.
It's Elements.
Could have been Zinc.
It's Elements, my dear Sturm. So they...
Could have been argon, neon, other noble gases.
Argon, you quite done yet?
just try to go through all of the. Isn't Eisensteinium one of them?
Yeah,
when you get into the higher numbers, they just start putting names and then eum at the end.
Yeah, it's in the bottom row thing. The one that's not connected to anything else. The ones that they made in a lab and just like, yeah, sure, we'll just tack it on here at the bottom. But there's and no one who knows the periodic chart.
The deluxe edition.
We just skipped all the boring ones and went straight to the end. No, but nobody who actually knows science, please don't contact. We don't. It was the 70s. It was a different time. The elements were different. Let's not worry about it. Was Einsteinium even an element in the 70s?
Oh, that is a good question. I am Googling that right now. Einstein, I gotta spell this right. Einsteinium, there it is. Okay, here it is. Wikipedia article is loading. Yes, it's atomic number 99. When was it discovered? I don't care about its boiling point. I'm just trying to prove a point on a podcast. It's based synthesized from Mendelevium in 1955. Is that right?
Oh, great. Well, there you go. You have your answer. No. Your joke works. It's period appropriate.
Einsteinium was discovered as a component of the debris from the first hydrogen bomb explosion in 1952. That's nice.
Well, let's move on.
Let's go back to argon and neon.
Okay.
There's a guy dressed as Groot. There's a guy dressed as the Pinocchio thing at the party, and he says, it's not my nose that grows, in a very creepy way.
And there's also the lady with the cigarette head wig thing. That was...
Oh, yeah, that was nice.
That was interesting. And Ryan Gosling finds himself a seat, ordering drinks, and Russell Crowe is sort of pacing the place and not drinking because he's taking this very seriously. And they he comes across Holly in a room where they're watching something that Holly should not be watching, and he beats up the guy who's sort of dressed like Dionysus or something. Like, I'm not sure where they were going for, but I'm assuming Dionysus.
He's maybe like a Caligula thing.
Yeah. So he smashes Hedonism Bot's face into the glass coffee table.
And he does look like Hedonism Bot. Yeah. Except he's not built into the chair.
Yeah. But he doesn't move. You don't know he's not built into the chair. And so he apologizes once he realizes that the actress who was inside of the
the young lady.
Yeah, the young lady.
The young lady.
Yeah, is the one who decided to watch it and show it to Holly. And
by the way, that line is just too good earlier there when they're talking in the bowling alley and he decides to get all like, you know, serious and holier than thou when he says the porno young lady. Oh, so good.
Yeah. Also in the earlier scenes we have the whole thing with the don't say Anne stuff.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And that's a big deal because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have the later scenes, which are hilarious, including this scene where she's talking to the young lady and she says, don't say and stuff. Just say they're doing anal. And I just died laughing when Holly said it. Because it was just... It's so absurd. She's trying to act very adult, but
yeah, it's her moment to be adult and to show that she is grown up enough to be there, which she is absolutely not.
No, and all Russell Crowe says is that she needs to leave. He doesn't actually do anything about it. Russell Crowe comes across the office of Sid, finds all the stuff, including some suspiciously specific stationery inside of a film tin can thing, and also the exact pantsuit that had been described by the aunt in an earlier scene, the one with the Coke bottle glasses he was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember her as the lady from Minority Report, and she was in some Law and Orders, I think. But
was she really?
I think so. I mean, Dan, everybody's been in a Law and Order. One of these days, we should be in a Law and Order.
Oh, man. They're going to make me a bad guy.
Yeah. Well, there's a Law and Order they've delayed broadcasting because it is a story that is supposed to mirror a certain president-elect's life now, and they may never broadcast it.
Well, it is the responsibility of the arts to
chicken out,
protest the establishment or something.
Anyway, Gary Cole in it. I like Gary Cole.
Wait, does he play the guy?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's funny.
Okay, so we'll move on from here. And we have, unfortunately, Ryan Gosling getting progressively more inebriated and more inebriated. More inebriated, he swims in the tank. He misplaces all of the words in every sentence he says. He eventually gets up to talk to a lady on the balcony area and then falls over the side of the balcony in a way that surprises her, and she just walks back inside once he tumbles down the side of the hill. And this is how he comes across Sid, who is dead, and also across Amelia, who is not dead, and who runs away because he just starts talking about how he lost his gun.
It's a pretty good funny moment. Don't worry about it. You know, he's drunk. He has no idea what he looked like to this girl hiding in the bush. Don't worry, I just lost my gun. I found it. Like, yeah. He shouts back to her, found it.
Yeah.
Like, that's really going to help his situation.
No, and then he sits down, and we do the whole lighter thing, and it reveals the dead guy slept to the tree next to him, and all. It's pretty funny. And then he calls down to Russell Crowe, calls up to Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe comes down. He shows him the dead body who slumps over from the tree into the light, fortunately, so they don't have to keep doing the lighter thing. Then they decide they need to hide the body because otherwise it will look very incriminating, since he had identified himself to a young lady as someone who was looking for his gun, and this person is obviously very dead. And so they haul him over to a fence and chuck him over the fence, and then we cut to the other side of the fence where there is a table full of people who are presumably at the same party, just wrapped around a different angle or something, or they're just at the neighbors who are also having another party.
It's a wedding reception. They're all wearing tuxedos and wedding dresses.
And then it crashes on a table, and everybody freaks so out, good. And they look over the top and go, "Oh,
run!"
Run.
I also love that, like, he drunk, and I'm grabbing this guy's leg, and he's too drunk to say Baryshnikov. Just like all of the banter is so good. And I even love that, like, after he finds his gun and he's all exhausted from his tumble, he leans up against the tree and he does his little march, march, he's our man, if he can't do it, no one can. It's like, why is he singing himself a little, like, theme song as he lights his cigarette and sees the dead body?
Yeah, I don't know. And then there's all the stuff when they come across the bad guys, and there's fighting at the little tiny hot tub, so tiny, and the gun goes in it, and punching and fisticuffs, and then Russell Crowe goes in it, grabs the gun, shoots Keith David in the leg through the interior of the hot tub, which is pretty interesting. And meanwhile,
it's a pretty good fight.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, Holly, she came across somebody who said they were friends with Amelia, and it's like, oh, I'll take you to meet her. So she takes it to a limo. She gets inside the limo, And then it's the blue-faced guy who was in the limo with her. And they start having a little chit-chat about it because it occurred to him that she was perhaps connected with some people and that it would be important to take her, basically.
Yeah. And she lied and said she was Holly's sister so she could try and get some more information, but that turned out to be a bad thing to do because took her straight to Blueface because Blueface is a bad guy and he's looking around for Holly, or for
Amelia. Yeah, and
that's what I meant.
They there's a moment of tension, right, when they're about to drive off before he realizes that Amelia is at the valet stand too, and he is surprised by his great luck in this, opens the door, and he prepares to shoot Amelia. Holly pulls the door back in, knocking his hand, and it fires at the valet stand, scattering everybody, including Amelia. And then Holly falls out of there, tells Amelia to run, runs after with it, along with Amelia, and then the blue-faced guy is chasing after them in the car. And Ryan Gosling sees the car, chases after. He doesn't realize that Holly and Amelia didn't go in the same direction, but it doesn't matter because they all cross paths once more because apparently they ran down to the street. Amelia has an unfortunate habit of running through wooded areas that lead to streets where a car had obviously just turned from that she was trying to escape. Not that that happened twice in this film, but it happened twice in this film. And she
roads, how do they work?
Yeah, I don't know.
Switchbacks and things.
So she, at least in the...
It's a problem with the Hollywood Hills. It's very confusing. You end up right back where you started.
At least in the second instance, it's a little more forgiving since she didn't exactly see what the guy's car looked like or him up close. And, from a distance where she could recognize him from a car that's driving towards her. So, it's a little more excusable the second time. The first time, not so much. And so they get stopped by this guy. He gets out of the car and he's talking to them. And then Holly tries to say, watch out. And then he's hit by a van. The van opens the door. They weren't paying attention. They're like, oh no, get out of here. And then they peel off, leaving Holly and Amelia stranded with the hit-and-run victim, Mr. Blueface.
Yeah, and Holly's all like, oh God, she's hurt, or he's hurt, we gotta help him. And Amelia's like, no, he's trying to kill us, I'm running away, bye.
Yeah. In this case, I would have also gone with Amelia, because Holly also didn't even, like, knock the gun away from him. She's just like, oh, I'm gonna go hold your hand, you're gonna be all right. And it's just like, Holly, little too goody two shoes here. Fortunately, Russell Crowe comes over and smothers him to death.
he tells Holly to go find some help. But after that scene earlier, Healy said, you made an enemy here. You didn't do this professionally. You're a jerk. So when he had the opportunity, he smothered him, killed him. And then Holly was a little concerned, asked him if he did it. He said, no, of course not. I would never do such a thing because I don't want to lose the respect of this young girl, whatever. And then finally around the corner comes Ryan Gosling after he slid his car into a tree and then took a while to get it started again.
Yeah. And because of this dramatic incident, the police arrive, and we get introduced to Kim Basinger, who's the...
This is when the movie gets weird and plotty.
Yeah, I have to say, I have liked Kim Basinger in other roles. I'm not in love with the cameo performance that she has basically turned in here. It is a tad underwhelming for me. Doesn't quite seem to throw her all into it, which is unfortunate because I think it could have been an interesting character. It just didn't wind up being that interesting because I immediately knew that she was a horrible person and she was guilty and she was trying to get her daughter, and she had gotten everybody else killed to cover up everything about this film.
She seemed to be withholding from the very beginning, didn't she?
Yeah, she was not. It's one of those instances where it's a little frustrating that it was very obvious to me that she was not a good person, and they were immediately not suspicious of her at all because she was working for the Department of Justice, or she was the head of the department. I couldn't quite figure out exactly where she placed in the power structure.
She was. It's one of those things where you see in less good movies where they're like, you know, just a car pulls up and it's like, hello, I'm an important person. Come to my small office now where I tell you important things. It's like, is there going to be like a town car that pulls up and the president gets out and goes like, hello, characters of our movie, I need your help. Let's go to my office. Like, no.
Well, only if it's Richard Nixon.
Right, exactly. I love the Nixon sort of hallucination later in the movie too.
Yeah, that was a good tie-in.
Like yelling at it underwater, like no, get away from me.
No, but it was sort of a weird meandering thing, because then it sets up this whole thing about how she's in charge of prosecuting the car companies about the catalytic converter, and it's just like, oh god,
that's half her day, right? You know, yeah. Oh yeah, basically everyone's like, oh yeah, I recognize you from the newspaper. Oh, I also recognize you from the newspaper as well. We're all in the newspaper, how about that? Prosecuting big three automakers, catalytic converter, assumedly they falsified effectiveness or something so they could skip over EPA regulations
A car maker would never do that.
No one would ever attempt to circumvent regulation for their own profits.
No. Volkswagen. But the interesting thing here is...
Sorry, you sneezed there for a minute?
It was a German sneeze. It's fine. And so... lower emission. And so they have a little discussion, and of course we also get introduced to her assistant, who plays fun little card games, and there's a little side story about how she spends the rest of her time fighting against the expansion of pornography into Los Angeles, all of those horrible Las Vegas pornography outlets opening up in LA, and it's just like, well, we kind of know how that one went, but
how did it go, Joe? I don't live in Los Angeles.
Wasn't it like the capital at one point of making a certain kind of film?
Pretty sure it still is.
Yeah. So that's what I mean by that. So anyway, also curiously, Van Nuys. But anyway, we have her strange aside about that, and then her discussion about how her daughter wouldn't come to her, and this is her way of lashing out, is to be in these things that she doesn't approve of, and how she doesn't really want to get the police involved, but she'll get them involved. And Ryan Gosling's like, oh, I'll take $5,000 to go do this, and he's like, oh, fine, and she pays him, and they go out of there, go back to Ryan Gosling's pool, where he sits over his large ashtray, as Russell Crowe puts it, because there's no water in the pool, because it's just a rental, and there's this complicated story about the house that burned down and how they're going to rebuild it, but they haven't yet, and they're just renting this on a temporary basis, and how his wife had died in that fire, and he blames himself. It is really complicated, and I've seen...
But it's also a good, funny callback to previously when they got to the party, and he mentioned something about smelling weed or whatever. He goes, oh yeah, I can't smell.
Yeah, Mary Jane.
Private eye that can't smell. This keeps getting better and better, and Ryan Gosling, it's really insensitive.
But what?
By the way, I think Amanda's favorite line is from the earlier part of the movie, when he punches the window of the bar, when he's talking to the guy and gives him the shirt dollar bill, trying to convince him, and he says, "Yeah, she was in here drank bourbon martinis," and he says, "Well, that's disgusting."
Yeah.
Just great delivery, and then he's got his little shirt dollar bill.
Yeah, oh god, I love that. Especially,
what is a bourbon martini going to be? Is just bourbon?
I don't even
vermouth and olives.
I don't even. Well, since this is the Einsteinium Research Podcast, that's also look up bourbon martini.
I feel like that's not an actual thing.
I mean, it's auto completing, so unfortunately, it might be.
Let's see, Maker's Mark has a martini on their website. This is a terrible idea. Oh, I gotta type in my birthday, because, you know, you don't want to be interneting while under 21.
Yeah.
I don't know why I always type in some approximation of my actual birthday when I do this.
Because it's easier for you to remember?
I guess, sure. So we've got the Apple Manhattan, the bourbon... Oh, that's like a chocolate drink.
Bourbon Dram Ball.
Sour fashionable Manhattan. These are not
martinis.
No, but they're labeled as martinis. Yumly has a bourbon martini recipe.
I saw those as well in the DuckDuckGo results.
Floating. Who would put star anise in a friggin' bourbon martini? Bourbon, whiskey, apple cider, pomegranate, liqueur, limes, apple, and some other stuff. Goodness. All of these sound disgusting.
These sound absolutely gross. So anyway, it just confirms the story that it's...
I'm with Holland on this.
Yeah.
By the way, I love that his name is Holland March. That's like the perfect movie character name.
And his daughter's name is Holly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, Jackson Healy. Like, is there a more movie character name than Jackson Healy and Holland March?
No. But one of the weird things about this... And since you brought up the scene when he doesn't get what he wants from the guy who says, like, oh, I made this, and he holds up the baseball bat and he goes outside. When the guy locks up the bar and he goes to break in and he punches that glass, this is what I was saying earlier about, like, those instances where you would expect things to go the character's way because that's how it happens in these sorts of films, and it does not, because he slices his arm up with all of the broken glass around the window. He starts bleeding profusely. And to the point where he starts to pass out.
This is why you don't punch through glass ever, no matter what, because this is how it goes down.
No, it's so funny. Because like in a film, they punch and it's the breakaway glass that like turns into powder, and then they just reach in their arm and open the door. And that was obviously what the character was expecting would happen, but it wasn't the reality of it in the film. And so I quite enjoy that. But skipping back ahead to where we were at, he goes to sleep. They have their weird aside about building the house and all that. I really don't think that goes anywhere, but maybe they had some scenes where that had more of a payoff later in the film, but it didn't.
When he left, he saw Holly up there sort of sitting on the plot, reading a book in her former room. And, you know, she questions him about killing the guy, and she's, you know, trying to make the connection that they're actually friends now. Well, you know, not her necessarily, but
right.
Healy and her dad are friends and they're good people and stuff. Cause you know, earlier she flat out says to her dad that he's a bad person, and she would kind of like it for her that not to be the case anymore. So she's looking for good pals for her dad.
Yeah. It's just a little disappointing though, that the whole story, the backstory about them doesn't go anywhere. Like, they don't build the house by the end of the film, you know?
Well, I mean, he only made half of $5,000.
Yeah. But they just don't have a payoff for the scope of the story, where their house burned down and they're trying to build it back up again, and the wife was killed in it, and he blames himself. It didn't really seem like there was much of a payoff, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think this is a symptom of writing a script where you want something unexpected that would cause one character to open up to the other, and then you just sort of backtrack through the plot and then add little bits and pieces here about he can't smell a house burned down, sad, you know, relationship between him and his daughter, and it all stems from just this unusual thing where he can't smell gas and the house burned down.
Yeah, it just... But still, I would have liked more of a better... Like, I would have liked a better payoff for that story, with its significance to these characters. It didn't pan out. Moving on from that, we have the next day. It's the afternoon. And
yeah, he says, pick me up tomorrow afternoon. And he went to the bank, cashed his check, got his half of the money, got drunk, bought a, what did he say, magenta suit?
Yeah.
It's purple. It's magenta.
And so he gives him his half the money minus whatever it was for crashing the car, and that he would understand. And then they're just going to chill out, and they're just going to take it slow. And then Holly details how these plans usually work, where he says they're really close to a lead, and they're finding some stuff, and teases that out there, and then they go back in for some more money on the third day. And you know, Ryan Gosling's like, you know, you make it sound so negative, but it is. He's pretty heartless about how he conducts his business, where he makes it take a really long time, even when there is potentially somebody's life in the balance here. As they've seen in earlier film, earlier parts of the film, someone is going to go after her with lethal force, and they don't seem to have any urgency about it. They finally guilt him into action, and they talk about the piece of paper that Russell Crowe found and like what the letters and numbers mean, FLT and all that stuff. And it's just like, oh, but you don't understand is what that really means is it's the Burbank apartments that are on blah, 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 blah. And that's the unit number. And it's just like, oh, wow, we thought you were a fool this entire time, but you really knew what was up. And they go there and the place was torn down 2 years ago. Yeah. So good.
Oh, the world's worst detective, huh? And he's like, got a cool looking ad, though. It's his own ad. It's taped in the refrigerator.
Yeah. Oh, so good. And he starts to profusely apologize as they speed off back towards the Burbank airport, because they used to have the flight restrictions, which is why he says that it can't be that, but now he's sort of reluctantly saying, like, oh, maybe it could be that. And then, of course, they stop at the Burbank Western Hotel, and they realize that it's actually the hotel where she's going to be meeting somebody, and they get in there, and it's the time the meeting's supposed to be at. They talk to the bar guy, he beats up the bar guy, he says, you know, we could do this the easy way, or the way I'm doing it right now is the easy way, we could do it worse than it is pretty funny. But
that is my one joke in this movie that is recycled from other things that I really dislike, is the he'll stop doing it thing and then he pulls on the tie. Like, that's not a new joke, and I don't like that joke.
I'm sorry. Well, it was new in the 70s. But so the
not, you think they wrote this in the 70s and just sat on it for 40 years?
That is exactly correct. No, it isn't. But so they realize that they need to go up to this penthouse, and, you know, there's a difference between the smart thing to do and the right thing to do, and they go up there, and there is a fight that is taking place, and they participate in said fight, and people are going out of windows and stuff, and then they go back down to their car, and then Amelia falls onto the roof of their car, and then they take Amelia back to their place.
This is one of the many places in the movie where there was a different take used in the trailer, and I prefer the trailer take. Like, they pop their heads out of the elevator and they see the guy like bleeding from the neck, and then they see some guy get shot and go flying out the window, and then they just like hit the down button back on the elevator. Russell Crowe's just standing there, and Ryan Gosling is just like violently shaking with fear, but in the trailer he started dry heaving and making vomiting noises, and I found that far more funny.
Sorry, Dan.
The other one is in the end there when he shows him the new ad. He said, I made your head look really small because I know you're self-conscious about your big head in the trailer. you should watch the trailer. It's funny.
So they have their realization that they have her now. They take her back. They wait till she wakes up. They realize that Holly and Janet, no, Jessica, they realize that they weren't over at Jessica's. They were there. Because Jessica's sister had somebody over, and then they talk about how promiscuous Jessica's sister is, and Jessica's like, yeah, I know. And then they debate how to wake her up. She finally wakes up. She explains the whole thing about how this is all about the catalytic converter and how they had made an experimental film in order to relay the message of the evidence.
The nudity was just the commercial element.
Yeah, they had all the evidence against their mother, and they couldn't go to anyone else, and this is the only way that they could do it, but they needed a commercial element, which is what Sid said, which is why they did all the porn stuff, and that was why it was there, and they were going to get the screen and get the word out, and man, and you know, she only cares about mammon and blah, 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 blah. She goes off on all she keeps going off these weird tangents about corruption of capitalism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it seems relatively unhinged. And they get out of there and they talk to what's-her-face back over at the office, because she's calling them because Kim Basinger is going to take a lot of money over to a place and they'd be more comfortable if he did it, and that they're going to send a doctor over now that they realize that Amelia's there, the family doctor. Suspicious.
That's one scene I had to watch again after I watched this, because I was sort of like half watching because I'd seen it a couple times now. But the whole, like, why did she call and have him come over with the case of money? She said, Kim Basinger called her and she wouldn't explain why, but she needed $100,000 in cash and I'd feel a lot better if you cared. It's like, that's a weird thing to throw in here, but yeah, it's all in there for that the fun scene with the bumblebee.
Oh man, played by Hannibal Buress.
Burris. Yeah, Hannibal's great.
Mm-hmm. And
he's born to play a bee for all I you know. There's the recurring thing about the killer bees too, because he talked about that at, was it the party? He was talking about the bar guy, the bartender. You got to watch out for the killer bees. You know why? Because they'll kill you. It's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because he had read that in the newspaper that looked like it was printed on a laser printer and then like folded up. It was not a convincingly aged piece of newsprint. And they also have their conversation about the ankle gun. That he well, has.
Driving, yeah.
This sets up some important humor for later on in the film. But they have this conversation, and at first you're like, I don't understand, like, how could the car drive itself? Like, is this a joke he's playing on them? And then you're just like, oh, wait, there's a bee in the backseat. This car cannot drive itself. He is out of it. And of course he is out of it, and they drive out of it, because the car smash. And then the stuff goes everywhere out of the thing, and it's just like, that wasn't money. Oh, no, let's go to a payphone as quickly as possible. Nobody's picking up, because she was on the line trying to figure out the name of John Boy from the Waltons and stuff, because, you know, no IMDb or the ability to call when somebody else is using a line, because it's the 70s. And they make their way back there as fast as they can in his beat-up car from crashing. And meanwhile, Matt Bomer has arrived as the family doctor. And he is sufficiently creepy, but totally not a doctor. So I don't really...
But he has on black leather gloves and he has a small bag with him.
I don't really think that it was a convincing performance as a doctor, is all I'm saying. But he has a very distracting mole. I couldn't get past it. Like, every time they'd show his jaw and you could see... Because he has very chiseled jaw features, and then he just has this enormous mole that's sort of like pulsating back and forth across jaw muscles, and you're just like, stop it! Let's get rid of the mole! But
doesn't even Jessica say when she's on the phone, she said, what was the name of the guy that played John Boy who had the hockey puck on his face?
Yeah.
I guess that's a thing. I don't know anything about that show.
I don't know anything about the Waltons either, but... She was basically just trying to see if he would respond to that, because she was suspicious of him as maybe being that John Boy guy that Russell Crowe had mentioned, that Blue Guy had said before he unfortunately met his end.
Yeah, and she was smart enough to read the scene, see there was something weird with this guy, offers him a cookie, and Jessica almost ruins it. She's like, no, I ate all the cookies. He's like, no, I got one more in the cookie jar. And she goes and gets the gun out of the cookie jar and tells him to put his hands up. But, of course, Jessica doesn't understand how, I don't know, distance or geometry works, no. And she, like, runs right past him and gets grabbed and thrown out of a window.
Yeah, and then they get there just in time to hear that. And they're getting out of the car and walking over, and they see the guy walking down the street, and they're like, did you hear that? And the guy's like, yeah, I did. And then he opens up his trunk and then pulls out his whatever that is. And he's like, yeah, I threw a girl out the window. And then he starts shooting him up. And they quickly dodge every bullet, which is a little unbelievable in this context. But they get out of the way fast enough, and they have a nice little battle here. They eventually get to a point where he drives off in his car, reluctantly, and they are left to try to find what has happened to the interior of the house and where the kids are, etc. And Holly and Jessica are fine, but Amelia's gone. Because she saw what was happening and peeled off out of there because that was no longer a safe space for her. Unfortunately, she ran through the woods again and crossed the street, and the first car she tries to hail is Matt Bomer, and he couldn't even believe it either, which is rather hilarious. And so he pulls up and then shoots her dead right there, and she falls to the ground. Police come again, and the next scene is some guy who is getting them out of a thing. Was that their lawyer? A lawyer?
It appeared to be, yeah, a friend of Ryan Gosling's who was a lawyer.
Yeah, I couldn't quite place exactly I mean, they were friendly, but I couldn't quite place exactly the relationship of them. But they...
Either that or he was a... Because Ryan Gosling was formerly a police officer, so maybe it's a friend of his who was still a cop.
Yeah, and they talk about how there's no real case they could bring against Kim Basinger because there's... It's just not going to happen. And they don't know what to do now, and they feel very defeated about all of this. And Holly's like, I could use a drink. And they get back to the house, and I never liked that palm tree. And the aunt shows up, and she's very upset that he hasn't found her niece, Misty, yet. And they go at it again, and she describes... You know, exactly where she saw again, and this makes them realize that, oh, maybe this was about a copy of the film, and they go back to the apartment, Misty's apartment. They talk about how she saw her through the window. They go inside. They look at all the stuff. He finds the film projector, and he's like, oh, you saw the film projected up here, and she was in that suit, and that's the same suit that he saw, which was the costume, which is why that's all tied together. Now, at this point in the film. And so what that means is there's a copy of the film, and oh, she was trying to get it distributed, which is why she was at the hotel, that she was going to meet them and distribute it through them, and because of that stuff that didn't happen, so she must be trying to get this shown somewhere. Where is she going to get it shown? And somehow they arrive at the conclusion that, oh, today's the LA car show, so... Mm-hmm. That's the only logical place that you could project a film.
Well, that's the place where your film defaming the auto industry would, you know, have the most effect and be seen by the most people. Although it's probably not really the audience you would want for it. No. You wouldn't want the news necessarily there.
And something tells me they're not as receptive as some other audiences. So Holly says that very matter-of-factly, jinkies, and they... pile on into the Mystery Machine and go over to the LA Auto Show. And they, of course, realize that Chet is the projectionist, and Ryan Gosling could not be more upset about Chet. And there's some very bitter recriminations about, you know, about Chet. They get in there, realize he went to go get a drink, and they, thanks, buddy. Like, how did you know my name's Buddy? And it's just like, oh, jeez. Shane. Leave no stone unturned, Shane Black. And so they get up into that room, and what's-her-face, the assistant, comes in, and she is very stylish but deadly because she has a gun. And Russell Crowe's like, oh, you don't want to do this? Are you really a murderer? And she's like, I've killed three people in Detroit, which is where all this started, when Misty talked about blah, 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 blah. And Russell Crowe's like, oh, that's not really the answer I expected. And Ryan Gosling's like, yeah, but, you know, are you really blah, 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 blah? And he's like, you know, one time, you know, whatever, but three times, it's not really an accident. And so they...
You're not a killer. She just killed three people. I know, but deep down.
It's a good back and forth. And there's room service. And when that occurs, Ryan Gosling ducks for the ankle gun, starts groping at Russell Crowe's ankles. And this alarms the assistant lady, who is just like, Tally is her name. And she's just like, what is he doing? Why is he doing that? And Ryan Gosling is flopping around like a dead fish on the ground. There's nothing stealthy or precise about his movements. His whole body is moving around. Legs flopping, torso twisting, everything. And it's just like, it's just his ankle. You would have found it with just your hands. Like, I don't understand. But he gives it his all. And then he realizes that he actually only figured that out from the dream, that it doesn't mean he actually has an ankle gun. And they come to that realization. Then Holly gets let in by Tally. And Tally wants Holly to go stand over with the other people. And she's like, okay. And she throws coffee at her, and at first you're just like, oh no, coffee. And then you're like, oh wait, why did you just throw cold coffee at me?
She stole a room service cart that's been sitting out there for hours.
Yeah, she's just like, I just found it in the hallway. I just thought it would be hot.
And then in a double twist, she goes to take a step and slips in her high heels and falls down and hits her head on the ground and shoots a lamp.
Yes.
So it worked.
Yeah, in a very roundabout way. And they put a pillow under her head and they get out of the projection room.
It's great because this whole time Ryan Gosling is like hitting on her and very interested in her, even when she's pointing a gun at him.
Yep.
Never lets up. Puts a pillow on her head because she's probably a good person still.
Yes, deep down. And so Matt Bomer's also here with his mole, and he's walking around looking for Chet. And Keith David is here, also walking around looking for Chet. Matt Bomer finds Chet, beats...
Yeah, they split up, go into different bars looking for him. Both sides do, the good guys and the bad guys. Ryan Gosling goes to the roof bar, where it's an open bar, and that very much catches his attention, so he... has a drink, and Russell Crowe goes to the downstairs bar where he gets a hint from somebody in the kitchen that Chet may have gone out back, and he finds him beat up in a dumpster.
Yeah, and he gets the information, as the audience gets the information from Matt Bomer, which he had extracted when he beat him up, that the film was spliced into the reel for the rest of the car stuff for the car show, and that's where... all of the evidence is back in the projection room. And of course, it's on a timer, so it starts projecting, even though nobody's there to do it, except, well, technically Tally, but she's asleep. And the projection is interrupted by the logo for Sid and then Misty Mountains, and everybody's treated to this on the big screen. Matt Bomer realizes this is bad and puts a grenade inside of a Cadillac on a rotating platform and blows it up and starts trying to shoot the projection room, which is not a solid plan, but it does wake up Tally.
Not terribly discreet, no.
No. And Holly gets the film can out of there. I think we glossed over the part where Ryan Gosling was only playing drunk and he had actually used self-control in order to not be drunk so that he could deceive Keith David, and they were both knocked over the side and Ryan Gosling landed in the pool and Keith David splatted in a very big...
Yeah, Keith David also got shot.
Yes.
A bunch of times.
Yes.
But I do love that he has a sunglasses on, he spins around and he starts like scatting like jazz music or whatever mm-hmm. he's trying to do just to mess with Keith David. It turned out very good. And then, he lands in the water, doesn't die, sees somebody wearing a Richard Nixon mask floating in the pool, staring at him, so he freaks out, gets out of the water, yeah. And runs towards the gunfire.
Yeah.
Always a smart decision.
I love when he goes behind the Corvette Stingray for cover, but it's on a rotating platform, and then when he finally catches his breath to go shoot over the car, as you might expect in a traditional film... he leans over and tries to shoot over the side, but now the car has rotated around, so he's facing backwards. That's good for a laugh because the shot just whizzes by him before he realizes and ducks out of there again. Matt Bomer, and the guys who work for the Detroit show, everybody's fighting and there's lots of stuff and they're trying to get the film, and Holly throws the film at the window thing and everybody catches and runs and catches and runs and catches and runs. And eventually they get to a point where, they have a big climactic fight and the pin gets pulled on the grenade and there's an explosion, but it's some other dude. And then Matt Bomer, is still there and he beats him up. And then, Holly's like, don't kill him. If you do that, I'll never talk to you again. And so he doesn't kill him and just knocks him out. And, Ryan Gosling escaped from the other guy and got the film and has it there. And he's got his cigarette as the police pull up to it. And they have their day in court, so to speak, where they sit there in a weird bench facing one way, and Kim Basinger comes over and sits in a weird bench facing the other way. And they have a very stilted conversation about how, you know, nothing's going to change because of this. And I didn't really want to kill my daughter. Detroit guys killed my daughter, and she would have been alive if you guys had just done your job and brought her to me. And somebody's going to take my place. It's always somebody to blah 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 blah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're like, yeah, whatever, but we got you. And then, sure enough, cut to the next scene. They're at some sort of Mexican restaurant with a bar of some description, and they relay to one another the casual news that their case is unsuccessful, that everything went through no matter what, and nobody believes a word of it. There's not enough evidence to prosecute anybody for anything, and just like they said, that was it. And you know, oh well, nothing bad happened. It's just like all those people died. It's just like, you know.
that was a good line too. Mm-hmm. Nobody got hurt. Well, some people got hurt. They died quickly, is what I mean. They probably didn't get hurt.
Yeah, but and then he shows him the new ad, which has the terrible drawings of them.
Nice guys at Detective Agency.
Yeah.
And they got to get it together because they've got a case. Where was their case? I can't remember. It was up north somewhere. Some woman thinks her 80-year-old husband is sleeping with Linda Carter.
Yeah. And it's like, Wonder Woman? We got to figure out if it's Wonder Woman or Linda Carter. But, you know, he's 82, so there's not much time to figure it out. Whatever. That's the end.
And then there's a bee next to Ryan Gosling. They start freaking out and smacking it with the ad and like, yeah, something else, trying to kill it, because the problem with them killer bees, they'll kill you.
Yep.
I don't know why that was a running theme throughout this movie, but it was amusing.
Well, there was a big concern in the 1970s about the killer bees and catalytic converter pollution and gasoline prices.
Well, then I'm glad that as a person who lived through the 70s, I understood all of those callbacks.
I didn't live through those things, but I'm familiar with the aspects of American history.
I missed those ones.
Well, I mean, mostly I think read about things on Wikipedia sometimes, but it was mostly because everybody always complained about the Carter administration. I was like, what was so bad about it anyway? And then I just started reading.
Well, the gas shortage, of course, that's, yeah, pretty well known, especially because we had, how long ago was it that we had that other one?
I don't know.
I remember waiting in line in my car trying to get some gas.
I've never had to do that.
Oh, yeah, it was,
Was that when the refinery thing happened or whatever, or was that when the recession happened and they had to tap into the strategic oil reserves or something?
I honest to God could not tell you. I was very young, and I just remember waiting in a very long line at one specific gas station 15, 20 minutes away because there were no other gas stations that had gas.
Wow, that's weird. I've never had that
happen.
It was
very weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the one up there on Kyrene and Baseline.
Oh, very familiar with that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
It's near and dear to my heart.
It's over by the Kiwanis Park.
Okay.
They got a wave pool there.
Is it a lot of fun?
It's a cool place, yeah. That's where I went to a lot of birthday parties as a kid.
I don't know anything about Kiwanis
Club. I don't either. It's just a big public park. Oh. They have a wave pool and tennis courts and stuff.
Oh.
That's where that boomerang gif on my Instagram of me swinging around in that thing the other week was from.
Oh, I don't think I saw it.
Jason saw it.
Oh. I'm sorry. I'm not as proficient on Instagram as everyone else is.
It's fine.
It's where all the happiness in the world is, and right now all I need is despair.
All you need is despair. It's good.
Yeah.
So this movie ends on a sad note for the world of the film, but it's good that it brought our characters closer together. They're going to work together.
Yeah.
You think they're going to make a sequel to this? Would you watch it if they did?
Oh, I would. In a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear that they have any immediate plans, but if they did, I would totally watch it.
Ryan Gosling's little mustache and soul patch is pretty good too.
I also enjoyed his flippy, wavy hair with the sideburns. That was entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I like when they meet each other in the bathroom stall and he has to stand up with the magazine.
Yeah, that scene also is almost entirely in the trailer as well. It's quite funny.
Yeah. Well,
it's a good movie. I like this movie.
I like it too. It's a lot of fun. Go watch it. If you, if you listen to this entire thing, it might be substantially less enjoyable than if you had just watched the film. But whatever.
Yeah, for real. What are you people doing? Go watch the movie.
Yeah, I mean it's only 2 hours long, so
it's it's a little longer than this podcast. Hour 56.
Yeah. It's not.
It's a very weird structure though, because it's not like your traditional three act. I mean, it kind of is, but it's very like chunked, segmented, and shifts gears halfway through once you realize that there's actually like the story thing going on. But thank goodness that it's funny and it's an entertaining ride.
Yeah. Apparently, at one point, it was going to not be in the 70s. It was going to be contemporary.
Well, that would have been terrible.
Yeah. Also, it was apparently going to be a script for a CBS television pilot.
What?
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yep.
Did you enjoy all of the various green screens?
You know, for this kind of movie, it's fine.
I don't know why I didn't assume it, but I watched some of the behind the scenes. The window to the mermaid tank was a green screen too. That was one of the more effective ones.
Yeah, no, it was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got the reflection stuff in the metal bar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had that sort of, I don't know, it wasn't necessarily stainless steel, but it was metallic.
Yep, you got all your various driving things. I don't love the animation of the car in the opening scene driving off the mountain in that through the window way out in the back there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little weird. I like his beat up old convertible Mercedes too.
Yeah, it was nice.
Good car for him.
Mm-hmm. Opening weekend, the film grossed $11.3 million, finishing fourth at the box office behind Angry Birds the Movie, Captain America Civil War, and Neighbors 2.
It's not a great turnout, unfortunately.
No, I think Warner Brothers should have possibly put this on a different weekend and perhaps increase the marketing budget.
Probably.
But this appears to be one of those instances where maybe Warner Brothers wanted to save a pretty penny.
Bunch of jerks.
Yep.
This is
the whole budget was $50 million.
It was only gross 36 in the US. Oh, I don't have worldwide here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, no, that's worldwide. 36 also. Jeez.
What? It's 57.3 million on Wikipedia.
Hmm. IMDb. Terrible.
Hmm. It's still underperforming, technically. If you take into account that the budget was 50 million and then that doesn't include the marketing, which would typically be almost as much as the film, then that's not great. But maybe it'll make it up in 99-cent DVD in 99-cent streaming rentals on Amazon.
Oh, I'm sure it'll totally make its money back doing that.
Yeah.
I pre-ordered, bought it on iTunes as soon as I could. It's great.
Yeah. I would consider owning this one.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Not that I would watch it a lot.
Movie that Joe actually likes.
I mean, no one is more surprised than I am.
You liked something.
Well, no, that I like something that you picked.
Hmm.
I mean, what are the odds, Dan? Let's be honest. Because you don't like space things and explosions and stuff. And
you don't like things that are set on Earth.
Well, let's just say I don't usually like the films that you greatly enjoy as much as you greatly enjoy them.
I feel like I should be offended by that.
Yeah, probably should. But you know, I mean, there's no bad movies that... I mean, the movies you like are not bad movies, and the movies I like are also not bad movies, but they do not really necessarily overlap oftentimes. So it's good when they do, because then we can both agree on things, and then we can realize that we are a united podcast that can work together during any transitional period into our next movie, and that it'll be just fine.
So depressing.
Yep, on that happy note.
By the way, did you happen to see Boom in the chat mentioned that the marketing turned him off for this? I didn't actually see this until like a week or two ago. There was a I don't know if they ran them as TV commercials or whatever, but they put like Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe in like couples therapy together. It was like a jokey little thing that they did. You can watch, like, there's like three or four of them, and it's a total of like 9 minutes. And what's her name? Bernadette from Big Bang Theory plays their therapist, and it's just kind of jokey, silly fun. But that was a marketing thing they did for this.
They should not have done that.
It's kind of funny, like, now. I wouldn't want to see it before the movie.
Yeah.
Just go watch the trailer. The trailer's good, and I do wish that they would have used some of those trailer takes. Maybe they thought that they had been seen, and they wanted to put some unexpected stuff in here, but...
Or maybe they thought it didn't read well in a trailer. But, who are we to guess the sublime intelligence of Warner Brothers marketing department?
Here they make those trailers. It's entirely different companies, so...
Yeah, I know. I've worked on films at a different place, and marketing is completely, entirely separate from the actual production of the picture. And marketing has some interesting demands on some occasions, and they sometimes desire things that are not in the film, and they cut things together the way they want to cut things. And it is an interesting process, especially if you're dealing with VFX for trailer-specific things, and maybe it makes you a little grumpy if they do that.
Hmm. Boo.
Yeah. Like, not to name any names, but if you were to look at a talking animal movie, and it had a trailer, and the animals were saying completely different things inside of the trailer than they were saying inside of the movie, you'd be like, I wonder why they wasted all that money. And that way, it might be a thought that might have occurred to other people, too. But there's nothing you can do about that, because you're not in the marketing department.
That's unfortunate. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I have similar stories about a thing.
We should save that for another time. This is,
well, let's just say I delivered a thing at some point, maybe recently, maybe not recently. And then they're like, oh, by the way, can we also have the same video when you just cut the first 12 seconds off of it? Because we want to submit it to a contest, and there's a time limit on the contest. I'm like,
that's not how editing works.
Just cut the first 12 seconds off, sure. Client is always right. What do you say?
Yeah, deliverables. How do they work?
Well, you make one, and then you cut the front of it off, and then you send the second one. I at least gave it an additional music mix, so it starts at the beginning of the song instead of arbitrarily in the middle of
it. You should have just dissolved it on, just fade in.
I did, out of like anger, and then I watched it and I'm like, I can probably loop this without too much more effort, so fine, whatever.
You and your integrity.
No, I don't have any of that. It's just I needed a distraction today.
Yeah. Well, when we start our
last year when I made that video.
Oh, God.
Cut all of this out.
The presidential election of 2015.
I didn't say what I needed a distraction from.
The final moments of our podcast here, we should probably dwell on the fact that we should probably start our own agency, just like the Nice Guys did. And
oh, cool.
We'll have a badly drawn version of our heads. And
well, you've already got that like drawn version of your avatar. Do you still use that in Skype? No, you don't use that in Skype anymore. Where do you use that? In one of the Slacks, right?
No. I mean, I have the one that's sort of like a pixelated version of a photo, but it's not like drawn.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Okay.
It's like a drawing of, it's a narrowed focus Slack.
No, but I want a Ryan Gosling one. I want a good one. I want a good bad one.
I can trace your face kind of like what I did for my avatar in the defocus Slack.
Great.
I just took a picture and then traced it and then put a gradient to make it look like there was some depth to my head.
Oh, no. We can't do gradients because they didn't have gradients for desktop publishing in the 1970s. We gotta make it look very 1970s.
Can you grow a mustache and a soul patch?
I can, and I won't.
I think it would be great for our brand.
I feel like it would be bad for me as a human being.
You can just start wearing shirts with very large collars and then get you a magenta suit. Oh wait, I've got the shiny blue suit. Does that mean I'm the one that wears the tacky suits?
Well,
would you rather wear a leather jacket and like a shirt that doesn't really fit?
Was it really leather?
His blue jacket? It was a form of leather.
It seemed very vinyl-esque in a certain way. Whatever it was, it didn't feel like it would breathe very well.
No. Well, no. I mean, it's Los Angeles. It's cool there.
Not that cool, but yeah.
It's tepid.
Tepid.
All of that smog really raised the temperature.
Well, what it does is it traps the heat in, so...
Mm-hmm.
It actually makes it worse.
So your food stays fresh longer.
Exactly. There was so much fresh food in the 1970s.
Sure. You just go grab it right out of the ocean right there.
Exactly. Because the water quality was also superb.
Fish to table or whatever.
You just sound so defeated.
Yeah. I think that's going to be my new brand.
Defeat?
Mm-hmm. Defeated. Can we be the defeated guys? That'll be our...
The defeated podcast?
That works, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I wish I had the energy or the effort to make a custom show art for this one where it's our faces in the style of the newspaper ad with the defocused in a newspaper ad style kind of thing.
That's what I was basically trying to lead you on to this entire time. Do it, Dan.
Custom show art. You have to leave it up the whole time, right? Like, not just... Well, after the first, like, what, 2 minutes where we were being all sad.
Oh, no,
stuff.
It would be up the entire time.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll do that as something to distract myself from the world ending / the fact that I don't have any work.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm going to do to distract myself?
Go to work and or bed.
Yes.
Is that a diet soda?
No, I mean yes. But have a good night, Dan. Good night, everyone. Good night, America.
Good night, everyone. Don't forget, have your pets spayed or neutered. Wasn't that show in the '70s?
Yes,
wait,
Price
what's
is Right.
Price is Right. He would say that at the end of that every episode, right?
Yes.
Yeah. See, I'm topical.
You're super topical.
Topical like an ointment.
Ooh.
Booyah.
Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah. Hey. Oh, baby, love and happiness.
Love and happiness. Hey.
Love and happiness.
Love and
I'll be good to you.